Now we're continuing with the tractate of Sanhedrin, and I want to just review one point, the halachic point that we made last week, because I feel it's something new, perhaps, you know, in terms of the halachic abstraction. And we have in Torah is not just a system of philosophy and psychology and civil law and religious law. It's also a system, an educational system. And as we learn Torah, we come across certain educational principles. And one of them is review. And now review in learning Torah doesn't mean simply repeating over what we learned in order that we should remember it. That's not review. That's review in a college-style review. You review things over so you remember them for a test. But in the Torah system of education, review is really part of the learning process. In other words, reviewing is refining, going over again, and after you see the idea, you review it through many different ways of expressing it so that you refine it as much as possible. That's why it says one of the 48 ways that Torah is acquired is through lengthy speech. That means that that when a person studies, it's important that he shouldn't just think in his mind, but he should express it verbally. Verbalization is really a further development of thinking, and part of that process is that first when you learn something, so then you grasp the ideas. But then you have to review. When you review, that's when you really crystallize the concepts and the ideas. And that's why the concept of review is so important. The Talmud says if a person studies and doesn't review, it's like a person that plants and doesn't harvest, because the reviewing is the harvest process. That's the final formulation. So with that little introduction, let me just review the concept that we did last week. The question we had was that there are seven laws of Noah, and then one of the scholars of the Talmud adds the blood from the living animal. And we said that the debate here is not a question of seven or eight. Everybody agrees seven. We've shown that from a further piece of Talmud that the number seven was carried down from Sinai. So that's not debatable. So therefore, it was when the blood from the living was added, it wasn't added as a new law, but that particular scholar thought that the law of the of consuming a limb that was taken from an animal during its lifetime also includes the blood. It's one law. And we explained that there are two ways to construe, two ways to understand what exactly the law is, that a person is not permitted to consume the limb of an animal that's taken during its lifetime. One way is straight and plain. The law is simply you cannot take the limb from the animal during its lifetime, and then one is not allowed to consume that. If that's the case, then blood would not be included. We've shown that. Okay, because we've shown that a human being is not permitted to eat a human being, yet the blood of a human being is permissible, according to the Torah law. The rabbis made a violation on that too, for obvious reasons. But the Torah laws, it's permissible. So you see that blood and the flesh are two different things. So if you understand the law of Aver Menachai, that's what it is in Hebrew. It means the limb of a living animal to be a violation of taking the limb, simply taking the limb, so then you'd only be referring to the flesh of the limb, not to the blood. But there's another way to construe it. Another way to understand this is that the organism of the animal during its lifetime is totally prohibited. And in order to become permissible, what you require is the event of death. And the moment the event of death takes place, then it's a permit on the everything that's included in the animal. So if that is the case, so that would include the entire organism, would include the blood as well. Now, the here is something where we're studying halacha, so we have to become familiar with the framework of halacha. And here we have a concept of an halachic event. So just like in physics, you have an event in physics. You could have if an electron changes its orbit, that's a subatomic event. Now we have to, when we study Torah, we have to realize that there is a new realm of events, and that is called halachic events. Now, according to this way of interpreting, what we need in order to consume the animal is the halachic event of death. So death now, when an animal dies, it becomes an halachic event. Okay? So so this event is what gives the individual a permit, so to speak, to consume that organism. If blood was taken from the animal, or anything was taken from the animal itself, aside from the milk, but if anything was taken from the animal itself during its lifetime, then there's no permit because it's alive. So there are two ways to understand the violation of a limb of a living animal. One way is to the removal of the limb is the violation, and consuming the limb that was removed. Or the other way is that the entire animal is in a state of prohibition during its lifetime. What you need is the halachic event of death. And death is a permit on everything that is in the animal, everything that's a part of the animal, which would include the blood as well. Okay, but the important thing to get used to is this concept of an halachic event, and the concept that an halachic event can act as a permit and can give a person a right, certain rights, which he didn't have previously. This would be the way of understanding the law of limb of a removal of a limb of an animal during its lifetime. It's not the rule of the limb that's the prohibition. The prohibition is partaking of any animal before the halachic event takes place that gives you the permit, which is namely the death of the animal. Okay? So if that's the way we construe it, so then it would include, you'd say the death is a permit on the organism. It would include the blood, any part of the animal whatsoever. So we see here that there are two ways to describe, to define, to define the halacha. And this is the way, I mean, from this case, you begin to see how to interpret a piece of Talmud. Every time you have an argument, you must go to the source, find out what was carried down from Sinai that is not debatable, and then see why each one takes a different position. And the reason that they take a different position is because they interpret it differently. They understand the concept of law to be different than the other individual. And based upon the way they understand the concept, different consequences emerge. Okay, this is a good example of how halacha works, and you'll see this continuously. As we go along, I would like to also be able to have you develop to the point where you can distinguish between a halachic question and a philosophical question. Because halacha and philosophy are two different things in the system of Torah. They're both important, they're both there, but they're different and they're treated differently. I'll take a question now that occurred to me. The question is that we see that the Torah always goes against and tries to uproot the attachment that man has to pagan and idolatrous practices. Like, even though according to the Talmud, by the way, with regard to this argument, we maintain that a ben noach is not prohibited to drink the blood. But the ben Israel is not permitted to have blood, to drink blood, and that's because, as Maimonides explains very well, because people always thought that blood has certain powers, and drinking the blood gives a person certain mystical powers. And of course, the Torah is against that kind of idea, that kind of mystical idea. So the Torah made it a primary violation to drink the blood. Drinking blood is like an idolatrous kind of thing. If you take the consume the blood of the animal, then you think you're gaining the power of the power and the strength of the animal. As a matter of fact, one of the primitive practices was to take an animal, and different clans had different animals that were gods to them. And what they would do is they would sacrifice that animal like once a year or so, and then they'd have a big meal called a totem meal, and they would consume the flesh and the blood of the animal, you see. Now, consuming the flesh and the blood gave these people the feeling that they are now partaking of their god, because they're consuming the god's flesh and blood, and now they're gaining the strength of the god. This is a very strong primitive religious urge, and I think you recognize it very quickly in the Christian Christian Eucharist, the blood and the flesh of they consume the blood and the flesh of their God. Again, it's the exact same practice. But the Torah, of course, prohibits these things because they're primitive and they take a person away from the real God and they put them in the realm of idolatry. So it's a prohibition. But what's interesting is that really, according to Maimonides, where the flesh of a human being is a prohibition, it's not as strict a prohibition as eating an animal which is prohibited, like a pig or a horse or a camel or one of the animals that are non-kosher. So it's interesting, and I say it's not as severe because violation against eating pig is a negative violation, which is stronger. It says you should not eat this animal. Violation against eating a horse or a camel or any non-kosher, a lion or a bear, any non-kosher animal, is a negative violation, which is always stronger. The violation against eating a human being is only, according to Maimonides, is only a positive violation. Of course, the Torah says you should only eat these things. It excludes anything else. So that would exclude man. Now you understand, and it's logical, that a negative violation is always stronger than a positive. Of course, a positive is an indirect kind of thing. Like the Torah says, this is what you should eat, to the exclusion of man. But there's no specific mention in the Torah, nowhere in Leviticus does it state you should not eat man. Okay? Now, according to Nachmanides, Nachmanides disagrees. Nachmanides maintains that there isn't even any violation of the Torah at all for eating a human being. The question that arose in my mind goes against the primitive and tries to uproot them. I mean, that's the whole purpose of the Torah, to uproot the primitive practices. Yet, one of the most primitive practices, if a person studies at all the cultures of the primitive people, one of the most primitive practices was cannibalism. Cannibalism was a very, very strong instinct in primitive society. And it's interesting, but the Torah, it seems strange, why did the Torah ban and outlaw cannibalism, as it did the drinking of blood and partaking of an animal during its, while it's alive, these primitive practices. Why didn't the Torah also outlaw cannibalism, which is consuming human flesh, okay? I believe the answer is that the cannibalistic state, if you study the level of people that are in a cannibalistic society, that state is so low and so far removed from the world of knowledge that they aren't even capable of receiving any laws or commandments. So I believe the reason is that the Torah was given to people that have to at least be on the level. You see, the violation has to at least be on the level where the person is in the realm of receiving a commandment. Cannibalistic society is so primitive that You don't have to outlaw it, because if you're referring to those type of instincts, then you can't be giving the law to those type of people. And if you're not, if people are above the cannibalistic stage, then there's no reason to prohibit it. But you see, the Torah really never prohibited, never had any specific prohibition against cannibalism. And I believe the reason is because it's assumed that that the people that are receiving the law are out of that, are beyond that stage. If they're in that stage, then it's, of course there's no, it's hopeless. The people are, can't even receive any law in that stage. Okay, now. Now this is what I want to mention to you. What you should have noticed is that I switched out of halacha to philosophy. This type of a question, why did the Torah not prohibit the consumption of human flesh, is not a halacha question. It's a philosophical question. And it's important to note that, because as we have to feel and to see and to recognize what is halacha and what isn't, the two different subjects. So we've digressed into a philosophical point. But it's okay to digress, but what you have to know when we digress, you have to recognize that it's a digression. Because if this is a class that is going to, that we hope to advance in Talmud in, then we have to always keep our categories straight in our minds as we study. So it's okay to digress, but we got to realize which realm we're in, what framework are we in, when. Okay, so now let's get back to the Talmud itself. The point that we made last week was with regard to that piece of the tractate of, we're going to continue and take the other positions as well. Okay. So that's 56B. Now, we mentioned the position, and now we're going to skip over the next one, the one of Reb Chitke. We'll come back to that one. He says even the castration of animals. Okay. Now, even castration is a prohibition. Now we're going, certainly of humans as well. Now, according to Rabbi Simon, we're skipping over Rabbi Chitke. We'll come back to him. We're going to go to Rabbi Simon. Rabbi Simon says, even it is a violation for a Ben Noah even to be involved in magic. All right? And then Rabbi Josi says, he adds, and he says, whatever is mentioned, not just simple magic, but whatever is mentioned in the section of the Torah, in the paragraph of the Torah that deals with magic, a Ben Noah is prohibited to violate. And here is the section of the Torah. And what we're going to do is we're going to go back to the source, as we should, and take a look at the Bible itself, because we're going to be explaining some verses in the Bible. Now, the verses that he's referring to are Deuteronomy 18, okay? Now, if you take a look, we're going to have to take the trouble of looking into the Bible itself and seeing what the statements are. So 18:9, it says, I'll just give a loose translation. It says that because you are coming to the land that God your God is giving you, you shall not learn to do like the abominations of these nations. All right? It's important to mention that when it says you shall not learn to do, so the Talmud immediately, the oral law states, that it means you're not permitted to study these things when you're studying them, you're studying them because you want to learn to do them. But you are permitted to study them in order to understand what these things are, and know what they are and understand them, that is permissible. But if a person is curious about them and he just studies them because he's drawn to them emotionally, that is a violation of the Torah. Because it doesn't say you shouldn't do. It says you shall not study to do. You shall not learn to do. So even the learning process is a violation. But the Talmud explains, the oral law explains very beautifully, that these two words go together. You shall not learn to do. It's a kind of learning which may result in doing. Even if there's a chance it'll result in doing, it's prohibited. It means learning out of curiosity because you feel emotionally drawn to those practices. That's a prohibition itself. But if you're studying the practice in order to understand it, in order to be able to comprehend how people were, the psychology of it, the nature of it, or anything about it that has to do with knowledge, that is not prohibited. As a matter of fact, the Sanhedrin had to study these things, and because they had to pass judgment on it, so it wasn't just a matter of an optional study, they had to know it. And any area of knowledge, the Torah always tells a person to study and to gain knowledge, all kinds of knowledge. There's no knowledge that's prohibited in the Torah. But studying because one is emotionally drawn to it, that's a dangerous thing. Okay, now verse 10. Verse 10 says, there shall not be found among you anyone who makes to pass his son or his daughter in fire. And that was a form of idolatry, as you probably know. And then you have the next few words. Actually, it's four different statements. Four different categories here. You have the first one, in Hebrew it's kosem kesamim. I don't know what your translation says, but these are different types of magic. And I'll explain what they are to you. Okay? There are four of them. Okay. The first one of them is called kosem kesamim. Now, what that means is as follows. That means a person, these different forms, and recognize some of them even today, but not all of them, because times have changed. But this one is where a person, in order to be able to forecast your, what the person does is, he tries to meditate, so to speak, to get his mind blank, so that this even today we're familiar with, to get his mind to a blank state, so that some kind of future events will come into his mind, and then he believes that those things that came into his mind under that trance are true. Okay? So that's a kind of a trance meditational phenomena where the person believes that when he puts himself in this trance and he gets certain feelings and certain thoughts, that these that's the first one. Second one is, again, commonly recognized today. It's astrology. That a person says, this day is a good day, that day is a bad day. All right? Today is bad. If you study the stars, you'll see that it's not your lucky day. So the best thing for you to do is stay in bed today. That is the second. That's the second one. That's a Torah violation. That's called Ma'onein. Okay. Now we have another one. The next one is Menachesh in Hebrew. What that means is that a person says he makes signs for himself, like he says, I spilled my coffee, or this something dropped, or a black cat crossed the street, or any kind of thing like that. And then he says, because that happened, I'm not going to go. I was going to do this business deal. I was going to see this person, but nope, that's bad luck, and I'm not going. That's the third category, again, a violation. The last one in this verse is called Mechashev. Now, Mechashev is what that means is the person does magic. Okay, magic, sleight of hand. And the question, of course, arises, is sleight of hand a prohibition today? And the answer is that there are certain times. Now, this happens to be an interesting thing because it's unusual. So usually, halacha has a very rigid form. And if you violate the form, then that's the violation. God does not want you to do that action. Over here, the form is tied to the situation. And it's rare, but there are cases like that. In other words, doing magic in a way where you people the idea that there's some force, a power here, that is a prohibition. But if it's done as a trick, and people know it's a trick, then it's not a violation. Okay, so that's the opinion of many scholars, including my teacher, Rabbi Feinstein. I one time discussed this with him. That in this case, you have a few cases like that where the violation, and it makes a lot of sense, that the violation is not the trick. I mean, a car trick or doing something, taking a bunny out of a rabbit, is not a violation as long as you aren't implying that you have some supernatural force. If everyone knows it's a trick, then it's not a violation. Now, it's strange because usually in Allah is more rigid than that. But there are certain cases like that. I'll give you another example. Another example is, you know that there's a violation of Torah for a man to wear women's clothing and vice versa. Now, many times on Purim, which is a holiday in which, you know, there's a very jovial holiday, so people have plays and they have men come out as women, you know, and different things like that. So in the Shulchan Aruch, it's stated that that is permissible. Of course, the violation of the Torah for a man to dress as a woman and vice versa, one of the reasons or the framework of it is to actually disguise one's sex. But if it's done if everyone knows it's just a joke, so then the halachic violation is not in existence. So these are rare cases, I want you to know. They're rare, and you have to know exactly where it is that way. But there are cases in the Torah where the framework and the setting plays a role. The setting and the framework of the event plays a role. And this is one of the cases, the one that we're studying now, the case of doing magic, like a sleight of hand and various magic tricks that people do today. If it is done in a way that one implies that he has some power, supernatural power, and by the way, that is very common as well. I mean, there are many instances of charlatans today, and they still around, still exist, that do certain things that they claim that they have certain powers. And as a matter of fact, there's one magician who's called the Amazing Randy, and he always, what he does is to disclose what these individuals are doing. And his lifetime work is to take the power and show exactly what they're doing to the public. And he's done that on a number of occasions, which, in the eyes of the Torah, is a mitzvah, by the way. That is the proper thing to do, to show that this is nonsense and people are being fooled by these things. He's had a few shows on television, by the way, which I've seen and which are quite interesting. And of course, this is the proper thing. This is proper. Those people who are implying that they have powers are an example of what the Torah would consider a major violation, to perform something which appears to be magical, and to imply that they're able to do this because of certain powers. Okay, now we're up to verse 11. And in verse 11, the first one we have, I don't know what your translation is, so I'm just going to say, I'll just read it in Hebrew. Okay. Chover, chover is what it is in Hebrew. It's a hard one with that ch. But what it means is, as Maimonides explains, it means that the person says certain magical words, incantations, and he believes that these incantations are going to be effective. They have some efficacy in bringing about some positive or type of result. Okay, it's usually words that are like that.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We must change the tape.